37.
Dad, I say, leaning over the hole. Stay down there. Cass, stay with them. The argument on the tip of her tongue is cut short when I say, please, and my voice actually cracks.
What the hell did you find?
The elder Kuzneski asks, showing no sign of following us to the surface. I'm going to either need you and your shotgun up here or just the shotgun, I say to him. Take your pick. The debate takes longer than I'd prefer, but he steps toward the ladder, shotgun over his shoulder. Chris, I say, using his first name to help distinguish which of the two I'm talking to. Doesn't work. They both look up and say, yeah? I point my finger at the younger of the two. Stay put, but I'll be needing that. I shift my finger to the handgun he's holding. Without any resistance, he tosses the weapon up into my hands. As the older Kuzneski climbs, I address my father. Only reason you should come up here is if I call you. Sit tight until we get back.
What if you don't get back?
Owen asks. It's a great question, to which I don't have an answer. We'll jump that hurdle when we get to it, my father says, then looks me in the eyes. But come back. I reckon I'll do my best, I say. Do better than that, Cassie says. I smile at her, lingering over the hatch. Not because I'm lost in the melodrama of what could be our last goodbye, but because I really don't want to face the carnage behind me.
You looking for a smooch? Future Kuzneski says.
He's reached the top of the ladder. I'm blocking his ascent. I lean back and let him pass. He climbs up through the thick snow, then stands and dusts the white away.
Now what in the hell has your panties in a...
He turns and sees it.
Fuck.
That's one way to put it. Flores says, his phony accent gone, his military demeanor showing through. He's out among the mess, crouched down, inspecting the remains of horrific violence. Hey, I say, catching his eye. I toss him the handgun. Thanks, he says. This used to be two people. I look over the scene, trying to control my puke response, and I do my best to unpack the details. While the rest of the forest is coated in a smooth layer of thick snow, the patch of white just downhill is a wavy mess. Warm lumps of flesh and coagulated blood have melted through the snow before freezing in place. Body parts are scattered over the 40-foot-wide area, strewn about at random.
Were they eaten?
Future Kuzneski asks. He's pitched forward, hands on knees, a little bit of drool dangling from his lip. Hey, I say to him and nod my head at his shotgun. Stay on guard or give it to me. He slips the AA-12 around his shoulders and into his hands, but looks no more ready to do battle. Doesn't look like it, Flores says. Everything is here. Well, almost everything.
What's missing?
Future Kuzneski asks. I notice a moment before Flores reveals the horrible detail. There's no skin. And with that, the elder Kuzneski retches into the snow, adding one more pocket melted by human fluids. Chased by the scent of bile, I trudge into the field of death. Visually, the carnage is mind-numbing. I see bits and pieces of bodies that I can't even identify. Unexpected colors jump out at me, white and yellow. I've seen death before, but not like this. The only thing keeping me together is that the scene has been frozen solid and made odorless. The trees around us, many of them pines, where there will one day be oaks, sway and groan in the wind, keeping me on edge. Sul Kalu could still be nearby.
Why take the skins?
Flores asks, standing. He ejects the pistol's magazine, inspects the rounds, and slaps it back in. I don't even want to guess. I wade through one of a few clean paths to the death field's far side, stopping when I see a large set of bloody footprints leading away, following a much smaller set of prints. For all I know, Enola is one of the two people torn apart and scattered behind me. But I don't think so. Or maybe I just hope not. Enola is resourceful. I didn't get a good look at her two friends, but if they were part of Boone's bedraggled clan, I wouldn't expect much for them. If not for Enola, I'm sure they would have died before Tsul Kalu found them. Let's move, I say, following the oversized footprints that are twice the size of mine. If foot size is relational to height, that would put the giant at a little over 12 feet tall. Flores follows without complaint, but Future Kuzneski lingers by the open hatch. Close that. I point my gun at the open hatch. And move your ass before I put a round in it. He hesitates a moment and then closes the hatch. Tulkalu could never fit through the small hole, and I doubt he could force his way down. But I don't see the point in taking chances. The tracks take us downhill, weaving a chaotic path through the shrunken pine forest. I can't tell if Enola was trying to leave a confusing trail or was just running in a panic. If she saw what happened to the others, panic would be understandable. Muscles in my gut twitch with tension at the idea of confronting a giant from the past, capable of skinning people alive. It's not just brutal, it's malicious, which I suppose could be explained by the Nephilim theory. But demons fathering children with human women? I shake my head at the idea. It's more likely that this is a man with a genetic aberration, or a human growth hormone disorder, like Andre the Giant, though I doubt he could have torn a person apart with his bare hands. When I pause to inspect the trail ahead, Flores and Future Kuzneski stop beside me. After a moment, Kuzneski says, "So are you gonna tell me who this wolf in a hobo's clothing really is?" Flores gives him the same answer he gave me. "Sergeant David Flores, U.S. Army Ranger, retired." "So you were with Future him?" Kuzneski asks, and then looks at me. "And you knew?" Tension builds. Kuzneski's grip on the AA-12 tightens. A howl tears through the air. Downhill. Not far. It sounds angry, primal. I hold a finger to my lips and then creep forward. Flores follows on my six, while Kuzneski pauses for a moment before joining us. I'm sure he'd like to complain about our situation or the fact that I lied about Flores and my now-dead older self, but he shows uncommon restraint by keeping his mouth shut. When the trail takes us into open terrain, I leave it and head for the cover of thick trees. I move between the tall trunks in a crouch, creeping closer to the sound of a deep resonating huff. The giant is irritated. Then I see it. Just the back of its head at first. The size of it and the deep red color of its hair make me feel like I'm in a sci-fi movie, like what I'm seeing is being controlled by a gaggle of people wielding remote controls. But it also has a very alive quality to it, the way the hair blows in the wind, the fog rising with each throaty breath, that tells my brain two things. This is real, and get the fuck out. Ignoring my brain's second order, I stalk closer, placing each foot into the snow as slowly as possible. The giant's skin is pale but covered in tufts of hair, thicker than what's on its head but just as dark red, almost maroon. Like blood. We're just 20 feet behind the beast when I hold up a closed fist. Flores and Kuzneski both hold their positions behind two trees. When the giant stands, I reel back. I thought it was already standing. Its 13-foot height eradicates my genetic aberration theory. No human being has ever been this tall. The tallest person I've ever heard of was in the Guinness World Book of Records, and he was just shy of 9 feet. That's impressive too, but overly tall people are lanky. They look awkward, unable to grow into their height. They're stretched out. This giant looks more like an oversized extra from the 300 movie. His sculpted muscles twitch just beneath the skin, exuding power. With a flick of its arm, the thing flings a beige-colored cloak around its back. For a flash, I see its waist wrapped in tan fur. It's the mountain lion, I realize. The giant had been nude and is now making new clothing. My eyes flick back to the cloak and I nearly retch. Two human skins have been tied together in a bloody tapestry, still slick with gore on the inside. He's not a man, I think. He is a monster. The demon story is more and more likely. I force my eyes away from the skins and focus on the rest of him. Despite his reputation as a hunter, I don't see a single scar on Tulkalu, at least not from behind. With a grunt, he slams his huge hands into the ground, throwing snow and dirt behind him. He's digging, rooting something out, or someone. I catch Flores's and Kineski's eyes, hold up my gun and mouth the words, "On three." Both nod. I lift my hand, raising one finger. With a quick glance around the tree, I pick my target, the giant's head. I raise a second finger, imagining my next steps. I'll slide out from behind the tree and fire 3 rounds. My instinct will be to put a few rounds in its core, too, but I'll leave that to Kuzneski. The short version is that when I raise my next finger, Tsul'kalu isn't going to look much better than the carnage he left in his wake. My fingers lock at 2 when I hear a loud crunch of snow behind me. Did Flores or Kuzneski move? How could they be so careless? Tsul'kalu grunts and whips his big head around. For a moment, his eyes lock on me, peeking out from around the tree. He squints at me with intrigue and then amusement. This is wrong, my inner voice shouts. Get away now. Then another crunch of snow pulls the giant's gaze away from me, past Flores and Kuzneski. I follow the sound uphill and see the source for myself. A saber-toothed cat, low to the ground, ears folded back, teeth bared, and ready to pounce.